What's up, Chicago? I'm Erin Allen, and this is Curious City.
We're in Edgewater. We're on Magnolia, just north of Catalpa.
This is Curious City listener Bob Goldman. We're standing across the street from a school letting out, looking at a stamp etched into the ground.
It's this square that's been pressed into the sidewalk, and it says WPA 1938 inside the square.
WPA. That stands for the Works Progress Administration, which was a premier work relief program during the Great Depression.
We're standing on top of history as we speak. I most of the time don't pay attention, except when it's really cold and it's winter time and you're looking down because the wind is cutting through your skin, and you look down and you see this WPA square. You wonder what the heck that is.
We looked into these stamps, and it gave us a glimpse of the people behind the WPA in Chicago. The workers of the Works Progress Administration. Who were they? And why were they doing so much infrastructure work, like building sidewalks? Today, we're going to get into all of that. That's coming up after the break.
Curious City is supported by the Poetry Foundation, offering a roster of public events under the theme No One Can Afford to Lose Love. All are welcome to readings by exceptional local poets, including W.J. Lofton, Lisa Lowe, and Rob Makaisa Colgate, plus live musical performance by Decomposed, and more. Details at poetryfoundation.org. WBEZ is supported by Shedd Aquarium, where animals, people, science, and conservation come together. Through community outreach, education, and research, Shedd protects the water that supports life in the Great Lakes region and beyond. More at sheddaquarium.org. Shedd Aquarium, for animals, for people, for communities, for love of waterkind.
Young and Olmsted, 1904. Hofer and Co., Heffer and Co., Chicago, 1917. You're hearing me read off some of the sidewalk stamps Chicagoans have found across the city. And if you just look down, you'll find them everywhere. Arthur Bairstow, Lakeview, Chicago, 1906. That one's old. That's because the city of Chicago required contractors to sign their work, so to speak, before the WPA was ever conceived of. Cities across the country started requiring this around the turn of the 20th century, and they were a way to hold contractors accountable for not so good work, if needed. These days, they're still required. They have to include the contractor name and address and the year the work was done. And there has to be at least one stamp at each end of the stretch of sidewalk that was laid. Bill Savage is a professor at Northwestern University. He's writing a book about Chicago's roads and infrastructure. Bill says these stamps serve another purpose as well. It's free advertisement.
You need to get a new driveway put in. The sidewalk stamp might suggest to you who works in your neighborhood or what company does good work that you can see. Look at how beautiful this sidewalk is. I want those guys to do my job too.
This brings us back to the WPA sidewalk stamps specifically. During the Great Depression, national unemployment hovered between 8 and 25%. People needed jobs. So the Works Progress Administration was created as a part of President Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal. It gave workers jobs in so-called shovel-ready projects, like laying sidewalks. And the feds were proud of this. They wanted their propers. So the WPA sidewalks might have been stamped whether it was required or not.
I think of it as political signage. So whenever there's a big infrastructure development of some kind, a bridge, a viaduct, a road, there will be signs, you know, bronze plaques put on the thing saying who the mayor was, who the governor was, who the, you know, the guy who designed it. So the sidewalk stamps from the WPA have a similar function, you know, reminding people that this is a public good brought to you by the government rather than just something that magically happened.
And the WPA needed all the positive PR it could get. According to New Deal historian Tom Dorrance, the program was criticized because it was more expensive than other initiatives at the time, like direct cash payments to citizens. Also,
there's a lot of concern about adverse public sentiment. There's a lot of worry that like the public was really going to be against the WPA as like wasteful boondoggles.
Leaders of the WPA used branding to show that American tax dollars were going toward important work that needed to be done. So with all this effort to get credit for WPA work, is there any effort to preserve these sidewalk stamps? A lot of local history buffs are wondering the same thing. And no, it's not just our Curious City listeners. I came across websites, blogs, Reddit threads, and Blue Sky posts with photos of who knows how many sidewalk stamps sprawled across Chicago. Many of them are far older than the WPA stamps. And they've usually survived because a bridge or overpass has protected them from the elements, or they're just on a path less traveled. One historian mentioned he saw a brass plaque in Rogers Park dated 1904. Something that old, you'd think the city of Chicago would consider it worth saving, right? Nah. In a statement, the Department of Transportation said they, quote, don't maintain records or institutional knowledge specific to WPA stamps. Bill says, much to the chagrin of Chicago history nerds, that kind of makes sense.
Why would the city spend time and money maintaining a record of who poured concrete 120 years ago? What purpose would that serve? When you pour a new sidewalk, the old sidewalk square no longer performs its function because it won't be the same company doing it.
So, there is no coordinated effort to preserve WPA sidewalks. But maybe it's not about just the concrete. We might not know their names, but these stamps are a sign of the people behind the work. As we're fresh off of May Day, we're going to look at the workers and how they fit into Chicago's long history of labor organizing. That's coming up next.
This WBEZ podcast is supported by Wise, the app for international people using money around the globe. With the Wise account, you can send, spend, and receive in up to 40 currencies with only a few simple taps. Download the Wise app today or visit wise.com. Terms and conditions apply. Be smart. Get Wise. This WBEZ podcast is supported by the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. Connection is the greatest strength in the fight against suicide. Together, we can encourage those who are struggling to seek help and to know they're not alone. For free resources or to learn how you can get involved in their mission, visit afsp.org.
The workers behind WPA sidewalks, some of them had been unemployed for years.
They used to tell me I was building a dream, and so I followed them all.
And this song very much illustrates their perspective.
When there was earth to plow or guns to bear,
when I teach about the New Deal, I always play the song Brother, Can You Spare a Dime?
This is Tom Dorrance again, talking about what some called the anthem of the Great Depression.
The protagonist of the song has done everything you're supposed to do. They built the railroads, they fought in the war, they built skyscrapers, and now they're going around asking their friends for money.
Hey, don't you remember? I'm your pal. Buddy, can you spare a dime?
Tom says the Great Depression was the first time in American history when being unemployed, unable to provide for yourself and your family, wasn't necessarily seen as your fault. It could be something that happened to you, like a natural disaster. And this is the context of FDR's New Deal and the WPA workers within it.
It's people who are frustrated with the fact that they're not supposed to be poor. They're not supposed to be part of this unemployed group. And are really looking at the WPA as a way to really earn their money.
Infrastructure projects like building roads, parks, and sidewalks were the vast majority of what WPA workers did in the U.S., including in Chicago. But this type of work wasn't necessarily what these folks signed up for. The WPA was rolled out quickly, and some would say haphazardly.
There was definitely a lot of chaos during the early years and a lot of difficulty placing people in jobs that matched their skills. So a lot of these kind of very manual labor jobs, you had people there who were really not prepared or able to do that kind of work and are a little bit left in a lurch in terms of being given this job but not really having the physical capacity to do the work.
When the program started in 1935, unemployment was still really high. Roughly every fifth person of working age wasn't working. Franklin D. Roosevelt was 2 years into his presidency. The Works Progress Administration was the latest program of his New Deal, the pride of his early tenure. According to records from the Newberry Library, Illinois' unemployment rates were so high that it was among the first states to get New Deal funding. In 1935, Chicago Mayor Edward Kelly had just won by a landslide and started to usher in millions of WPA dollars for families struggling in the city.
September 1935, Mayor Edward Kelly, his face wreathed in smiles, returned home today with President Roosevelt's approval of all Chicago WPA projects, for which $150 million of federal aid money has been asked.
WPA jobs eventually included everything from sewing, writing, painting murals, academic research, child care, to quote-unquote shovel-ready work, like paving roads, developing city parks, and yes, installing sidewalks.
The Telegraph, August 1936. WPA sidewalk construction gang was busy completing the improvement in front of C.E. Stahl property.
And who were these sidewalk workers? They were poor Chicagoans. A lot of these folks had been getting cash assistance from the government, which in some cases made them eligible to apply for the WPA. Some were unskilled laborers. Others had skills and education, but they took what they could get. And there was a hierarchy of WPA jobs. Your race, gender, and citizenship influenced where you were placed. Women and immigrants were barely hired for WPA work. When they were, women were often relegated to gendered labor like childcare, sewing, and domestic work. Immigrants in Chicago, like Italians and Poles, were placed in more menial and low-paying jobs until the WPA barred all non-citizens from the program in 1939. A third of WPA workers in Chicago were Black, even though they made up only about 7% of the population, according to the Newberry Library. And they held a disproportionate amount of jobs with the lowest wages, often doing the most menial and difficult tasks, even though some of them were skilled and educated in other areas. They would have likely been the ones stamping all those sidewalks across Chicago.
There were far more Black applicants for WPA relief than there were white applicants. The Black community tended to be the ones that had the greatest relief needs.
Chicago had long been a union town, so when the program took effect, there was tension between WPA public workers versus privately contracted workers who were largely represented by the Chicago Federation of Labor. Even though everybody's skills were comparable, WPA workers earned lower wages than their unionized counterparts.
Initially, the wages were below standard scale, and that was intentionally done. And so they didn't want to incentivize people staying on WPA jobs if there's private sector jobs available. And so they, at least initially, kept the wages below whatever the prevailing rate would be for equivalent private sector jobs.
But WPA workers were not having it. Eventually, they started to organize and fight for better conditions. Normally, when unemployment rates are high, unionization is harder. If you give your employer trouble, they can just replace you with the many unemployed people waiting in line. That's according to Eric Rauschway, a history professor at the University of California, Davis. But, he says, WPA workers risked it anyway.
people work for the WPA long enough and have enough opinions about improving their conditions that sometimes they form unions and sometimes they go on strike against the WPA.
The Pentagraph, February 26, 1938. Chicago WPA crews hold brief strike. Chicago AP, two crews of WPA workers quit their task of enlarging the municipal airport Friday in a move for a longer workday.
It wasn't until the National Industrial Recovery Act in 1933 that there's a sort of federal stipulation that, you know, protects collective bargaining. And so there's an encouragement to unionization, even in the depths of the Depression. And, you know, at one point, Franklin Roosevelt even meets with one of these union leaders. So there's at least an implicit recognition that this is, legitimate.
In Chicago, the main organizing body of unemployed people was the Illinois Workers Alliance. They also represented WPA workers. Tom says early on, disputes were mostly about those misaligned work assignments, folks being hired for manual labor they couldn't really do. Then it was about wages.
And in 1937, with another funding act for the WPA, the wages were brought up to be on level with private sector jobs.
But the wages were a constant fight. In 1939, a new law called the Woodrum Act cut the WPA's budget and required employees to work more hours per month for less pay. Workers across the country resisted this. In Chicago, protesters marched outside a WPA administrative meeting with picket signs on Michigan Avenue. At its peak, the WPA provided work for 25 to 40% of unemployed Americans. Hundreds of artists were hired to document and portray the country's history and community life. By the end of the program, workers had built thousands of roads, buildings, bridges, and parks. Physical infrastructure is by nature impermanent. It gets used, worn, outdated. Sidewalks get replaced with newer, better sidewalks. And in the WPA stamps across the city, we'll never see the names of the people who stamped them. But we do know that they did what they needed to do to earn a living, to support themselves and their families, and to do so with dignity. In a way, that's their legacy. This week's Curious City was reported by me. Justin Bull is our producer. Susie Ahn is our editor. And I host the show. Curious City is a production of WBEZ Chicago and is a part of the NPR network. If you have questions about Chicago and the region, send them our way at curiouscity@wbez.org or visit us at wbez.org/curiouscity. I'm Erin Allen. Thank you for listening. I'll talk to you next week. WBEZ's new Prison Cast podcast takes your ears inside a world that's designed to be invisible. Hear stories and voices from inside Illinois prisons and jails on Prison Cast, wherever you get your podcasts.
Curious City is supported by the Poetry Foundation, offering a roster of public events under the theme No One Can Afford to Lose Love. All are welcome to readings by exceptional local poets, including W.J. Lofton, Lisa Lowe, and Rob Makaisa Colgate, plus live musical performance by Decomposed, and more. Details at poetryfoundation.org.